This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
At a time when magazines are rushing to embrace the digital age, the Virginia Quarterly Review reimagines and re-energizes that old-world form, the literary journal. Crisply designed, smartly written, full of not just fiction and poetry, but also topical reportage and memorable essays, VQR sets the bar extremely high and clears it time and time again. The Virginia Quarterly Review online at vqronline.org. And it's always an honor to welcome live into this studio the editor of the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review, Ted Genoese. How are you, sir? Welcome to the program.
I'm doing all right. How are you, Coy?
Good. And I should say welcome back to the lower 48.
Yeah, it's strange to be back. I think I'm still on Alaska time.
Are you? No, what's it? You've been in Alaska, for folks who don't know, and we're going to talk in depth in this hour all about your trip, but what's the time difference?
It's a four-hour time difference. It is, in fact, Alaska time.
Is it the same time as Hawaii?
Good question. I think Hawaii is 5 hours difference, but I'm not entirely
sure.
So
California is three behind.
Yes.
Another for Alaska and perhaps another for Hawaii. Interesting. Yeah. So it's like it's just afternoon there. Your
exactly
body's just
so.
Afternoon. You just had lunch.
I'm just starting to get hungry. So.
Oh, goodness gracious. So long trip. What's the plane ride like? How long is it?
It's a two-legged flight. It's not too bad. The flight, especially coming back, assuming there are no delays, which in our case there was this time, but it's about a 5.5 hour, 6 hour flight from Fairbanks to Minneapolis, and then 2 or 3 hours from Minneapolis back to D.C. So, it's long enough. I wouldn't want it to be
twice. Did they give you a movie?
As long. They don't give you anything on the airlines these days. You know that. They give us some peanuts.
The last time I haven't flown for years, but man, when I flew, it was like, here's a pillow, here's some food with real silverware, and you want to watch a movie. You know, it was pretty deluxe.
I was on a flight recently where they were charging for pillows. So,
holy cow!
Yeah.
You know, oh my gosh.
Forget about any sort of luxury.
We're talking with Ted Genoese of the Virginia Quarterly Review. I'm having trouble saying that today. So tell us what took you back to Alaska, because you've been there many times.
Yeah, it's true. The thing that took me most immediately back is that there's been record flooding from a really violent spring thaw along the Yukon Valley, stretching from the Yukon Territory in Canada and then through the Yukon Valley all the way across Alaska until it empties out into the ocean. And basically what happened this year was that the thaw came earlier and much warmer than it usually does, and it really is supposed to. And it sent a lot of water down into the river valley. And because for long stretches of the early parts of the river, it's running north, everything was melting first at the headwaters and was putting a whole lot of water into the river valley, and basically creating a huge swell of water behind this ice dam. And eventually, when the water started to run over the ice dam and melt the frozen river from that point, it sent all these huge, house-sized chunks of ice out onto the floodwaters and just sort of scoured the entire river valley clean.
Oh my God! Was anybody killed?
The last I knew, there were no fatalities, which was kind of amazing. We spent. I should say that I was there with a team of people reporting on this together, with Sam Harrell, who was there from the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and then Jesse Dukes, who's a local radio producer but was working for Studio 360. And then Ross McDermott, who's another local photographer who was there on his own hook and helping out at the final stages of the reporting. And we, over the course of the almost a week that we spent, I guess it was 5 days that we spent in Eagle, heard multiple stories of people in that particular town right on the border, which saw the worst flooding and the worst of the ice, who had harrowing stories of just sort of near misses with death. I mean, if they had made wrong decisions at critical times, there very easily could have been fatalities. But at last word, you know, everyone was fine.
We're talking with Ted Genoways of the Virginia Quarterly Review. If you look at a map of Alaska, where are we talking about?
Eagle is directly on the border between the Yukon and Alaska.
That real straight part.
That's right. So it's almost dead center of that straight line on the far eastern side. And Eagle is a fascinating small town. As remote as it is and hard to get there in a lot of ways, Eagle's got a lot of history, and not just great gold rush history. You know, it's the first of the gold rush towns to be settled in Alaska, and was, you know, a lot of the people from the Klondike who had come looking for their fortune there and all of that sort of history, but also a lot of great literary history. And that was the thing that first attracted me to Eagle when I went there in 1996. For people who know John McPhee's Coming Into the Country, about half of that book is set in Eagle. And many of the people that he wrote about in the mid-70s are still living there in Eagle and much a part of the community.
Did you read that book before you went there the first time?
I did,
Was that part of your motivation?
Yeah,
I've got to see this place?
Definitely.
And what was it about the book that really, because I've never read it, what was it that you made that tremendous effort to go all the way to actually stand in that place for yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was planning a trip to Alaska anyway. I wanted to see Alaska sort of in general. But McPhee, in his description of Eagle, had really made it out to be this sort of classic bush community that at the time it was only accessible once a week by plane. The only other way to get there was over a pretty dodgy road that was only open a few months out of the year. And so the people who lived there and lived there year round were pretty tough folks. I mean, these were people who chose to live mostly in isolation in a part of the country where you only get reliable daylight for about 6 months out of the year. And the 6 months that it's dark, it's not only dark, but it's, you know, these are sort of endless nights where it's 50 and 60 below zero. And, I'm intrigued by the kind of personality that would willingly seek out such a place and choose to settle there and live there.
Yeah, amazing. We're talking with Ted Genoways, my guest this hour, the editor of the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review, and we'll be giving away free copies this hour of the latest edition of the VQR, which explores in depth the subject of global warming, and which brings us back here to the subject of what happened in Eagle this year.
Right.
Was that global warming that caused this? I mean,
well, no one will say so outright, but when you talk to the climatologists, when you talk to the weather observers who are working collecting data for the climatologists, they'll all say, well, it was an unusually cold winter that produced unusually thick river ice, and it was unusually wet, producing a lot of snow up in the mountains, and then unusually warm come the spring that produced a lot of melt off and made everything melt sooner. And no one will say, you know, when you get so many unusual factors together, something is clearly going on. And yet all, it clearly fits the pattern of this sort of extreme shifts that you get these very, very cold winters and then rapidly very, very warm springs. And to go as they did this spring from temperatures that were still, you know, 30, 40 below up into the 80s in a matter of weeks is kind of unbelievable. And I think in Alaska that there's a kind of reluctance to confront the possibility that this is climate change, because you're talking about a state that is entirely dependent on the petroleum industry. And to say we think maybe this is climate change would mean changing the entire cultural climate of the state as well.
Now, what does that have to do with the petroleum, with oil?
Well, I just mean that I think if you're going to start talking about climate change, you have to start talking about the oil industry and talking about emissions and all of those sorts of things.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
And you know, the last thing that anybody wants in Alaska is to have something right at their doorstep that suggests that maybe it's time to start thinking about oil alternatives.
Right.
That's not a conversation you want to have in Alaska.
No, no. Because even the people who have nothing to do with the industry directly, everybody receives a stipend. Everybody is sort of tax subsidized by the oil industry. And in some cases, there are whole communities that are basically supported by subsidies that come from this.
Really?
And so
it's almost like a third world country living on, you know, the
absolutely.
Just the throwaways from some global national corporation that's drilling in their country.
And that's just it, that those companies have to make such concessions in terms of land, in terms of making funds available that there are many people in the state who basically are able to subsist and live in some cases relatively comfortably because of some of the concessions that the industry allows.
Yeah. We're talking with Ted Genoways of the Virginia Quarterly Review. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather and continue this conversation on the other side. When we get back, let's talk more about what happened to this village because I don't think anybody was killed, but you were telling me a number of homes were just wiped off the map.
Yeah, a lot of devastation for sure.
We'll talk about that and more when we get back. This is Charlottesville right now. Ted Genoways is the award-winning editor of the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review online at vqronline.org, and he joins us live in studio just back from Eagle, Alaska. So, Ted, remind us again what happened in Eagle. When did this happen? And tell us about the devastation that you saw firsthand.
Yeah, well, the flooding itself started about a month ago, and then when the ice jam actually broke up at the end of the first week of May, that's when these gigantic chunks of ice, I mean, they really are, you know, the size of semis or something like that, came in on the floodwaters and just crushed anything that was in its path. And by the time we got there in, I guess, about the third week of May, I had sort of expected, you know, it's been several weeks at this point. Things have been warming up. The ice will be starting to rot, as they say there. It'll be melting off and disappearing. I was shocked that when we got there, what we found was things very much in the condition that they had been for almost 3 weeks at that point, that people were still waiting for the ice to melt enough that they could get into their houses. People were just starting to get in and see, you know, what they could salvage from the wreckage. And these monumental, 12-foot tall pieces of ice that were sitting everywhere and stacked on top of houses, crushing cars.
You're kidding. Wow.
Just absolutely unreal. And by this point, everything had melted out just enough. You know, this is not like crystal clear ice. This is river ice that has all of the silt and the rocks and everything that gets sort of stirred up in it. So by the time it was melted down some at this point, it looked almost like boulders. I mean, it was like that ice that you see sort of on the side of the road or in the corner of the parking lot at the end of the winter that's piled up and is
the
just
nasty ice.
Exactly. And if you have to imagine chunks of that kind of ice that are, you know, twice as tall as you are, and everybody just having to wait until that stuff had melted enough to be able to get in. And in some cases, then they were using heavy equipment to start to push the ice out of the way, into the river.
We're talking with Ted Genoways. This is scary news in Alaska if you lose your home, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
You only have a certain few weeks to
get
a warm place to live, right?
That's it, exactly. And the issue that everybody is facing there is that it's virtually impossible on these river towns to get flood insurance. So it's not like everybody's waiting for the insurance company to come in, write them a check, and then they get to work. There's no money that's immediately available. And so everybody is having to just sort of do for themselves. And as you say, the period in which it's possible to do this kind of work is basically May to September. And even September is kind of pushing it. You know, it's going to be starting to snow in September. And so time is absolutely of the essence, and everybody is trying to move fast and hoping for relief to come from FEMA, from the federal government. And they've asked for federal relief to declare the entire Yukon Valley a disaster area and hopefully bring some dollars in to start the rebuilding as soon as possible.
Well, don't take them any of those poison trailers from New Orleans.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. one of the first proposals was to put a bunch of FEMA trailers on a barge and send them up and then truck them in. And
what did they have in them, formaldehyde, or what were they full
formaldehyde
of?
Formaldehyde. Yeah. And can you imagine one of those trailers at 60 below?
Yeah. I mean,
it's a terrible idea. But the locals in Eagle, to their great credit, have said, we don't want FEMA trailers. What we want is money to build log cabins. And everybody here knows how to build them. All we need are the resources to make this happen. And I'm pleased to say that at least at the state level, the FEMA representatives and the Homeland Security representatives who are also involved in disaster relief seem to recognize the wisdom of this plan, and hopefully that same recognition will dawn on the people at the national level.
So who are these people? Are these like natives? Or you said were they, you know, folks, you know, who went up in the 70s to get away from it all? And, you know, who is Eagle, Alaska?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. There is a native village that is about 40 people that is a little bit upriver. I mean, you're talking about stuff stretched over a couple of miles. The native village gets its own kind of support out of the state, which is again part of the concessions from the oil companies in the late 60s when they started doing drilling there. So they get their own support and have their own community there. Farther downriver, it's a total hodgepodge of people. It's a lot of people who decided that they were going to sort of drop out of society and that they were going to live by their wits, and there's certainly that contingent there. There are also people now who have lived there for two or three generations, and this is what they've always known. But it's a really motley assortment. I mean, there are gold miners who are there who have shown
really?
Up to do everything from sort of hand panning through industrial scale, you know, sort of small operation gold mining.
Is it like that TV show Northern Exposure? Just this little village out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska with all these really interesting characters?
Yeah, well, I mean, the people
and
are
a moose
sort of
walking down the road.
Things, I think that they would agree too that things are less sort of charmingly quirky. I mean, I think everybody there is much more no nonsense than that. Everything is basically a subsistence lifestyle, whether you're working, running one of the businesses in town, or for the National Park Service that has land directly adjacent to Eagle, or for the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management that runs some of the federal forests that are in the area, or if you're somebody who has a fishing camp and, you know, you have a cabin that you make your living just or survive by taking fish out of the river and ducks from the ponds and that sort of thing. Everybody who's there is scratching out an existence. And so people, I mean, there are odd personalities, but people are.
So they think Northern Exposure, that TV show, is a little silly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not, there's not all of the sort of free time that is shown on a show like that.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody is very task oriented and very interested in trying to get the things that they have to get done accomplished, especially, as you said, during the summer months when time is fleeting.
Yeah. We're talking with Ted Genoways. Now, you originally went up there and produced a body of poetry.
That's right.
Based in this region, right?
That's
based
right.
Based on this area.
Yeah, I was interested in this couple that had emigrated from Finland and had gone into the Klondike looking for their fortune in the gold fields. And when they arrived in Dawson City and found that the place was already staked and that all of the gold claims were already taken up, they moved downriver and set up in Eagle. And part of this trip, aside from wanting to go and see what had happened to the town and how the town was going to recover from this, was sparked by seeing that that the building that, that housed the artifacts related to this couple, especially dear to me, the washing machine and ironing board that Anna Malm had used to run her laundry business, supposedly the first laundry business in the state of Alaska. That part of the museum and the old customs house there was flooded and was beyond the flood wall that was built a few years ago. And so the whole customs house is sort of in danger of sliding off into the river. And so I wanted to see the building itself, but also what had become of the artifacts. And in point of fact, while we were there, we found the ironing board and were able to, see it and report on it a bit. The washing machine we never found. I'm sure it's around town someplace, but in the rush of trying to get everything back from the floodwaters as they came in and then the ice as it came in behind it, things got scattered, and we never did, while we were there, locate the washing machine.
And the name of your book that...
Is called Anna Washing.
Yeah.
Because so much of her existence was spent in town, in Eagle, washing clothes for all of the gold miners who were very much in need of some laundry. And her husband, Abe, was gold mining on American Creek, which is not physically all that far away, but far enough, especially at that time, that they wouldn't have seen each other all that much, and it would have been a really hard existence. And I was just intrigued that they had come thinking that they were going to find sort of easy fortune, and what they found was this divided life of extreme work and hardship.
Yeah, and just surviving.
Yeah, exactly.
And when was this, in the 1800s?
They came in the 1890s, came into Eagle in probably 1898 or 99.
Wow. And that's Anna Washing, a book of verse by Ted Genoways of the Virginia Quarterly Review. Speaking of the VQR, the current issue, the spring issue, has photographs.
Yes.
Speaking of sort of global warming, which we were talking about recently, photographs by Al Gore's wife, Tipper.
Tipper Gore, yes.
Always a favorite with conservatives. And her photographs that are in this edition of the VQR are also here in Charlottesville on exhibit as part of Look 3. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, they're up right now at the McGuffey. On the ground floor, as you go in, Joel Sartori's fantastic photos of the effects that global warming is having on frogs in the tropics is off to one side. And then Tipper's photos of what's happening with deglaciation is on the other side. And she's focusing in these photos specifically on Bishop Glacier, just one particular glacier in the Pacific Range in British Columbia. And yet it's a familiar story for anybody who saw the documentary that was produced by National Geographic in conjunction with James Balog and his project, the Extreme Ice Project. It's a familiar story that these glaciers are rapidly disappearing, and much like what happened in Eagle, the issue is really what happens once some of the glacial or some of the glacier is turned to glacial melt, that when the water is allowed to flow under and over the ice, it just melts so much faster. And what everybody's finding is that the rate of the melt-off is really accelerating, and that many of the original thoughts of how long the ice would be lasting is actually being foreshortened. And so these photographs,
This is happening a lot faster than anybody imagined.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, these photos are beautiful, and I hope that people will go to see them for that reason and will be sort of entranced by them. But it's also a reminder of just how fragile the glaciers are and how important the glaciers are to the survival of cultures and ecosystems that are around there. I mean, these are what feed the rivers. And then you think about everything that depends on freshwater rivers. It's really, it couldn't be more important.
Yeah. I was listening this morning. I can't remember which station I was listening to, but there was a scientist saying that the rise of the ocean water in the north, around America could be 4 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. This is going to flood cities.
It will. I mean, and that's
and this isn't far off. I mean, this kind of rise is possibly in our lifetime.
Yeah, yeah, and that's really the thing that I think that obviously Tipper and Al Gore both have been really trying to get people to be aware of, that this is not something that's off in the far distance and something that you say, well, I won't be around, I don't have to worry about that. You will be around, and you know, if you want to save our coastal cities, now is the time. Otherwise, we're going to be in a situation where they're going to have to be flood walls built around all of our coastal cities, which is going to be a tremendous expense and will be ripe for a situation like what we saw in New Orleans.
Amazing. We're talking with Ted Genovese of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And before we let you go, if you can, preview for us the summer edition, which should be out in a matter of days, right?
Yeah, well, it'll be out right around the 1st of July. So
a matter of weeks.
But yeah, the issue is off to press, and so it's as I was joking in the break, we're solving the problems of the Middle East in our summer issue. I think it's interesting that Obama has sort of chosen to tackle this issue at much the same time we have. I think that our motivations are similar, although our influence is obviously significantly less.
Don't sell yourself short.
I hope that I'm not.
You won the National Magazine Award.
I hope that Obama has more power to do something about this than I do. There are so many things that are happening in the region right now, and things seem to be at a point of transition. And I think Obama thought that it was important at this juncture to step in and try to express our interest in the region and our interest in certain outcomes in the region. And though we're not lobbying for any particular outcome, we did see, I think, much as they've perceived, that there are that we're at a kind of critical juncture, and we wanted to get reporters out documenting what's happening as there are these elections upcoming and some now that have been held, and trying to get some sense of what the Middle East is now and what it might become and what's at stake.
What do you think? What do you think when you look at it and you say it's a period of transition? What's the biggest thing you can point to where you can say, look, this something different is happening right now in the Middle East?
Well, the issue starts with a couple of reporters that we sent to the Gaza Strip at the very end of Operation Cast Lead. And I do think that there is a major shift in what's happening with American policy toward Israel right now. I think that Operation Cast Lead put Israel in a new light for a lot of Americans. And I think that the plight of the average person in the Gaza Strip is coming more to the fore. I think it also highlights the divide politically in the region, that Hamas is in conflict with Fatah, and the average citizen in the Gaza Strip is not really a supporter of Hamas and isn't as extreme as Hamas is, but they don't really have anywhere to turn either. That with the blockade, they are quite literally trapped in that region. And I think that Obama is seeking a way in which to work in the region that isn't quite as absolutist as it has been. And if he wants to put this sort of middle ground philosophy to the test, I can't imagine some place that would test it more seriously than the Middle East. But it's also the place where it may be most desperately needed. Otherwise, the region is just going to be hopelessly subdivided until there is no culture for the region really left.
One of America's best editors of one of America's best literary journals, Ted Genovese of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And we have free copies of the spring issue available. How many do we have?
We have three.
Three, and we'll give those to the first three callers at 977-1070. The spring issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review to the first three callers. Ted, as always, my friend, thank you so much for being here. And your story on your trip to Alaska, when can folks look forward to that?
Hopefully sometime in the early fall. I've got a quick deadline, so I hope they get it out fast too.
So you'll be working. That's in Mother Jones Magazine.
That's right.
Fantastic. That's right. Ted, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.